Now you may wonder, is this really a highlight of the Old Testament? Sometime you're watching highlight films of the NBA playoffs and you say, well, how did that make it to the highlights? You may be thinking the same thing about this episode with Jacob and Esau. Is this really a highlight, a turning point in the Old Testament? I would have to say yes, it is, because of the two sons, Jacob and Esau, and what ultimately would become of these two men and their descendants. And they have a lot to say to us today in terms of the family, because here we are detailed, graphically detailed in these chapters, what went wrong in the family of Jacob and Rebekah, or Isaac and Rebekah. And where they blew it as parents, so that it's so practical for us today to kind of get a handle on how do we properly raise children. And there are some answers and some no-nos that are given in this passage if we want to raise godly young men and women. And we're going to see that in these moments this morning. Now, Isaac is nearing 60 years of age. He had married Rebekah when he was 40 years of age. They had no children. Rebekah was not able to conceive. That's the background to all of this. So Isaac cries out to the Lord on behalf of Rebekah, and finally God honors his plea, a real lesson in praying. That it's important to be persevering in our prayer lives. Conception took place. Sometime after conception, however, before the birth, Rebekah began to realize that there was a problem in her womb, because every morning and during the night she was having these severe stomach aches and probably cramps. And she was wondering, if this is of God, why am I feeling all of this distress? And so she goes to the Lord and she cries out to the Lord, and God says, all right, here's the problem. Here's what you've got inside your womb. Two nations. You've got two children in there that are fighting. And it's a harbinger of things that are to come. It's a foretaste of what you're going to experience once these kids have come out of the womb and once they become young men. Not too many months ago, we were eating with my wife. I was eating with my wife. And our son-in-law and daughter and our three grandchildren, as we regularly do for pizza on Wednesday night at one of the local malls. And they have little rides there that the children can ride for a quarter. And I always take a pocketful of quarters, about $3 worth of quarters, that I waste every Wednesday night on the grandchildren. And Kelsey, who is 4 years of age, on one particular night, came back and said, Grandpa, can I have three more quarters? And I said, Kelsey, who are the three quarters for? She said, well, one's for Derek and one's for me. And I thought, well, that accounts for two of the three quarters. And I said, well, Kelsey, who's the third quarter for? And she said, well, that's for me too. And I looked at Don and Kelly and I said, if she's doing this at four, think of the problems you're going to have at 14. Manipulation. And we're going to see that when we get to chapter 27, how all of this now in chapter 27 becomes full bloom, and there is literally a war going on in this family. But what we see in chapter 25 is the beginning signs of a crack in the foundation. The fracturing family begins to develop in chapter 25. So here in this moment, God, in chapter 25 and verse 23, is declaring sort of the future of Jacob and Esau by sovereign election, that the promised line would go through Jacob rather than Esau, which would have been the normal procedure in passing the line on through the eldest son, the firstborn. Now, I want you to notice something here, because a lot of people get mixed up theologically on this. This has nothing to do with Jacob and Esau's eternal destination. We're left to guessing on that. Was Esau a true believer? We don't know. Was Jacob? We really don't know. Obviously, Jacob had to be, because we're going to sit down one day in the kingdom with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he's got to be there. Esau, we're sort of left to wondering, is Esau a true believer or not? But this does not mean that God eternally predestined for Jacob to experience blessing and eternally destined for Esau to be rejected. That's not what it's about. It's about temporal blessing in terms of the nation of Israel, in terms of the passing of the messianic line. So it applies to this lifetime. And this is what Esau gave up. But then the writer of Hebrews in chapter 12 uses it as a spiritual illustration that likewise we can be just as foolish as Esau in giving away that which is eternal for temporal pleasure. And that's the point. So if you don't understand that, it's going to confuse you theologically, and you're going to begin to take this too far in terms of predestination and election. Now, when the children are finally born, Esau comes out first, according to our text, with his younger brother holding on to his heel. This was so unusual that the name Jacob was apparently chosen to retain the memory of that occasion, like many today who name their children at the last minute based upon something that happened during the course of that birth as sort of a reminder of that. You find that particularly in a lot of foreign countries. And he comes out seizing the heel. This later connoted or suggested taken by the heel, tripped up, defrauded. And it was sort of an indication here, as God brings all of this together, of what was going to happen, that Jacob would later on trip up his brother Esau. He was not only holding onto his heel when they came out of the mother's womb, but he was going to be tripping him up by his heel later on in life. So it was a family that was going to be fragmented by war, and it was obvious from the moment they were born that this family was destined for a very difficult time. And the war would be between these two sons. The parents would take sides. You see nightly on the news pictures of war in Bosnia where families are being decimated. We read about it in the front page of our paper this morning in Rwanda and the tragedy that's happening there and the families that are literally being destroyed by war. But spiritual war in families in America and around the world is just as real, but we hear so little about it except from the pulpits in our land. And some of you this morning, you're right in the midst of a family war. In fact, you may have called a peace treaty momentarily while you're here in church this morning, but it's going to continue once you get back out in your cars and you're on your way, because there's all kinds of things that are happening in your relationship that are literally destroying you and tearing you apart. What can we learn from the lives of Jacob and Esau that might help us at this point? There are some principles here. Let me mention primarily two this morning. Two mistakes that were made with Isaac and Rebekah in regard to their children. Number one, there was the mistake of parental favoritism. Parental favoritism. Notice down in verse 27, so the boys grew and Esau was a skillful hunter. I mentioned in Hebrew it means literally intimately acquainted with. He was a knowledgeable hunter. You could ask Esau anything about hunting, and he knew all about hunting. He knew how to capture the various animals that would have been in the land at that particular time. Now notice it wasn't important. It wasn't necessary for Esau to have to hunt, and I got to be careful how I say this because I know we have a lot of hunters here this morning. But like in our day, it really wasn't necessary for Esau to be a hunter. They had plenty of herds, plenty of flocks, a lot of sheep, a lot of cattle, so it wasn't really necessary for Esau to learn the trade of hunting. But he learned it as a young man, and he learned it by the encouragement of his father. And he saw that this brought great pleasure to his father, so that his father was fed physically by the wild game that Esau was able to trip up and capture or trap. And at the same time, Esau was fed by the compliments of his father. So that his father, when Esau was a young man, really encouraged him because he had a natural inclination towards hunting. He encouraged Esau. He fed Esau in that direction so that he really motivated Esau in that direction. You say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, in this particular connection, Esau represents a man who was very immature. He was the ultimate material man. He was, as this hunter, as the text and narration would tell us, he was moving in the direction of being the ultimate man of the world. What was important to Esau was what was happening in the outdoors, you see. That kind of became his life. And as a result of that, he really did not have the spiritual orientation and the spiritual direction that Jacob had. Now, Jacob was not perfect. He was not mature in the sense that everything that Jacob did was right, because we're going to see later on, next week particularly, that Jacob made a lot of mistakes. But the big difference between Esau and Jacob was that Esau, who could have been today the editor of Field and Streams and some of these other sporting magazines, that Esau had a natural inclination towards the things of this world. Jacob, on the other hand, though he went about it wrongly, and though he defrauded his brother and took advantage of his brother Esau in these various moments of weakness, yet there was something about Jacob that he really desired, the spiritual, and that's why the birthright was so important to Jacob, but it wasn't all that important to Esau. In fact, to further substantiate my point on that, when it says that as the boys grew in verse 27, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man. This is better translated, a more well-rounded man. He was a more mature man. He was not just a homeboy who sat around and was sort of a mama's boy, as some people in the past have portrayed Jacob to be. He was not a mama's boy. He was a more mature man. He was a more well-rounded man. In contrast to Esau, everything that Esau lived for was hunting and pleasing his father with the game that he caught. In fact, the Hebrew word that's used here in verse 27 is the same word that's used of Job in Job chapter 1 and verse 8, where God says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no man who is more perfect," that's the word there, "and upright than my servant Job." Meaning that Job was a mature man. He was sort of the complete man as far as God sees him. He had a certain maturity about him, and Jacob likewise, that Esau did not have. I think of the contrast between a Dennis Rodman and a David Robinson. Does that help you? Not really. But it was obvious that there was a big difference in orientation between these two boys. And the problem comes in verse 28. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. Isaac loved Esau because of what Esau could do for him. That's what it means. He loved Esau because somehow maybe his father was living out in Esau what Isaac wished that he could have been. Ever that happen in your family? Jacob, on the other hand, was loved by Rebekah, according to verse 28. Doesn't say why, but Rebekah simply loved Jacob. It's obvious there is parental favoritism here. Now, I want to be fair to parents today, because I know that some of you have teenagers and you're probably already being accused of showing favoritism. Did you know, young people, that's normal? You're going to think that your parents are showing favoritism to a brother or a sister. That's normal. It really is. When I was growing up, I always thought, because I was the second born, that my dad and mom favored my oldest brother, Jim. And one day a number of years ago when Jim was down here, we were talking about it, and I said, "Jim, and I always thought that my dad and mom always favored you." And he said, "Well, I always thought dad and mom favored you." And you know what that is? That was perceived favoritism. I'm sure that if my dad and mom could come back today and talk about the four of us children, that they would say that we loved all four of those children equally. We recognized they all had different orientations. They had different interests. They had different personalities. They were just four totally different human beings. But we tried to treat them all the same way so that we showed favoritism to not any one of the four. I even thought that my dad and mom favored my younger brother and sister more, because after my mom died, he just seemed to become so lenient with my younger brother and sister. And I thought, "Dad, you didn't let me get away with that when I was in high school." Now, we went through that with our children. I didn't tell our daughters I was going to share this morning. But I know that our older daughter has always thought that we favored our younger daughter. But I also know that our younger daughter has always thought that we favored our older daughter. So that it's a catch-22. You really can't get away from this. But in this particular instance, There was no question about the fact that it was favoritism that was being shown. And Jacob knew that his dad favored his brother. And this set things in motion in Jacob that he somehow thought, even though God has promised these things to him, that ultimately he would have the birthright, he would have the blessing, that somehow Jacob thought in the flesh, I've got to go about getting this. I've got to get a hold of this. I've got to do it myself. And Esau knew that his mother favored his brother, and this would set them up for the conflict, which would later on come in chapter 26 and 27. And it was based upon what the boys could do. Esau had developed some outdoor skills. His father loved him for it. I cannot tell you the number of times that I've talked to young men, and many of you have in counseling, who have had all kinds of trouble in adulthood because their father wanted them to be a football player when they wanted to be a piano player. You know, the father wanted them to bang bodies when the boy really wanted to bang the keys of a piano. But the father sort of channeled the boy into that direction because in doing that, he's sort of living out his own childhood all over again through his son. One of the quickest ways you can destroy a child is by doing that. That's a lesson we learn from Isaac. This was all before Jim Dobson, so he didn't have the helps, obviously, that we have today. You know, we're without excuse if we do this. Isaac didn't have all these helpful books that have been written. I read just this week a recent survey of 6,000 high school students found that 95% of the high school students say that they go through life literally stressed out. 95% of the high school students say they're stressed out in life day after day after day. And many of them said it's because of their parents. The expectations of parents. The real proof of a father's love comes when the son doesn't measure up to his dad's expectations. He can't play ball like his dad did. He isn't gifted in the areas where his dad was. I read about a pastor, a very touching story, about a pastor somewhere here in Texas who had a son named Dolph, who was born with Down syndrome. And we have some children here in our church, Down syndrome. Little Michael Richards comes up to me every Sunday. He'll be here at the second service, grabs a hold of my leg and says, Pastor, was I good today? I'll say, Michael, you were so good today, I didn't hear you once. These are precious kids. Well, this pastor had a boy named Dolph. He was 27 years old, still living at home with his parents because he was born with Down syndrome. And everyone who meets Dolph can sense what a joy he is to his family and friends. He sings in the church choir, has a marvelous sense of humor. He also has a job that he takes very seriously. And one day, as he was riding to church with his father, Dolph said, Dad, I wish I could drive a car. His father's answer was so kind and gentle, he said, You know why you can't drive, don't you, Dolph? Dolph replied, Yes, Dad, because I have Down syndrome. In the state of Texas, I can't get a license. And one night when a visiting speaker had finished speaking in the church, he asked if anyone had any questions. Dolph had a question. He said, Do you think that if Jesus saw me, he would see someone who is not normal? Would he see someone with Down syndrome? And the church literally became silent, like you are at this moment. Dolph, the speaker, answered, I believe that Jesus would see what I see. When I look at you, I do not see someone with Down syndrome. I see a wonderful, delightful child of God. And it was obvious that Dolph liked the answer, beaming. Remember, his dad's a pastor. He said, I know just what you mean, because when I receive communion, I see the hands of my dad giving me the bread. I look up, and I do not see my dad, but I see the face of Jesus. And I thought to myself, there's a son who knew his father loved him. Even though obviously his father was terribly disappointed when he was born and after they found the news out, as any father would be. But he accepted it and he loved him, and there was no favoritism in that family. Now the second thing that we come to in this passage is that not only did the parents show parental favoritism, but the sons had a conflict in terms of their priorities. They were two young men, as I've already mentioned, that were going in two different directions. Esau was the material man. The thing that was important to Esau, the things that were important to Esau was what he could see, what he could get his hands on, those things that were tangible. That's what was important to Esau. But Jacob, on the other hand, he was a more mature man, and therefore Jacob had more of a spiritual orientation. And because of Jacob in his greater spiritual maturity, he was able with discernment to take advantage of his brother, which he should not have done, but he took advantage of a character flaw in his brother Esau, because he knew how much of a material man his brother was. And we're going to see how Jacob sought the things of God, but this morning I want to ask, what can we really learn from Esau as we conclude this morning? What can we learn from Esau? Now, according to this passage, and according to the passage in the book of Hebrews, the real problem with Esau was the problem of profanity. You say, you mean he cussed? No, he was a profane person. That's what Hebrews 12 says. He was a profane person. The word profanus in Latin means outside the temple, without religion. He was an irreligious man. That's what it means. He was a fornicator. He was an irreligious man. He was out of touch with God. What was important to Esau was now, right now, not tomorrow, not on down the road, but what's happening right now in my life. He lived for the moment. That was Esau. And because he lived for the moment, he was an irreligious person. He was a profane person. Profanity is just one aspect of that. Taking God's name in vain means that you are an irreligious person, or you are living as a profane person when you use profanity. In fact, I've heard it said that profanity is the effort of a feeble mind to express itself forcefully. And I would simply say that if you're a Christian and you're using profanity this morning, you need to stop it. You need to get down on your knees and you need to ask God to give you the victory, and you need to stay on your knees until you've got the victory. And the moment you take His name back in vain again, you need to go back to your knees, get cured, get help. And we see profanity as something that is terribly offensive to us as believers. But as it is offensive to us, remember that whenever we live as a profane person, we are offensive to God. And profanity or profaneness is something that covers more than just taking the name of God in vain. It means living for now. In fact, a profane person, as we look at this and as we analyze Esau, has three basic problems in the area of control. What are they? Number one, he's controlled by his natural appetites. Even becomes a victim of his natural appetites. We hear it said of people all the time. We say, he ate himself to death. He was a foodaholic. Or he drank himself to death. And some of you have family members and extended family members and friends that they're literally drinking themselves to death. We call him an alcoholic. Or here's a man that's just so consumed with his work that all he can see is his work. He doesn't see his family. He doesn't see ministry. He doesn't see his relationship with the Lord. He is consumed by working. We call him a workaholic. And in the end, the foodaholic, the alcoholic, the workaholic, they all become victims to their own appetites. That was Esau. And no one can create more chaos and discord in a family than a material man. I would say that to you young people this morning. If you're profane, if you're living an irreligious life, if you do not have a spiritual orientation, your parents do, there's going to be a conflict in your relationship. You need to re-examine the direction you're going, because in the end, it's going to be costly to you, as it was to Esau. You're going to be the loser. I can't say that soundly enough and forcefully enough to you young people this morning. Listen to your parents. It's important that you listen to them. Esau had that Dennis Rodman type of wildness, you know, and think of the dissension among the Spurs, even at this moment. Because one man is out of step with the rest of the family. And unfortunately, in this case, the father was encouraging it. Now, here's the scenario. Jacob had a stew that would simply knock your socks off. It was incredibly good stew. If he was living today, he would probably have his own chain of restaurants, and he would be selling this stew all over the country. Esau loved it. It had a red texture to it. He had ingredients in it that nobody else can match. And after a particularly exhausting hunting trip, Esau probably smelled the aroma of that soup before he ever reached the tent. He could smell it a couple hundred yards away, and he thought, oh my, am I ever hungry. He's thinking to himself, you know, I would kill for some of that soup right now that my brother makes. Connie makes some chili like that every once in a while. And Esau, in verse 30, pleads with him to feed him some of that red stuff. That's what he calls it. Red stuff. Feed me. And in the Hebrew, it literally means, it conveys the basic idea of gulping down food. In other words, he's putting on a front here that he's so hungry that he wants Jacob just to take some of that stew and just stuff it down his mouth, as you would do in that day, as the rabbis would use it, of stuffing food down the mouth of an animal that's too weak to eat. And you've got to do it in order that the animal might live. That's the Hebrew word that's used here. Stuff it down my throat, Jacob. Give me some of that good red stuff. It's so good, and I'm about to die. And then he goes on to say, what good is my birthright to me at this moment? I'm going to die. Obviously, he's not dying of starvation. You don't do that in one day. But he's guilty of exaggeration like you are. You come home at night and you say, honey, what's for dinner? I'm about to starve to death. That's exaggeration, obviously. But we're conveying an idea that we're exceptionally hungry after an exhausting trip, after an exhausting workday. Now we say, you know, that was really a stupid man, Esau, what he did here. It just doesn't make sense. It's stupid. And how many of us are victims of our own appetites today? Stop and think about your situation. The new house, the new car, the new furniture, the new clothes, the new jewelry. They've all put you in a position where you're so stressed out trying to make payments on all of these new things in order that you might satisfy that lust in that area. And if that's you, then you are living as a profane person. You're being controlled by your uncontrollable appetite in that particular direction. Or the sexual desires, they're so strong in your life right now that you find yourself in a relationship before marriage or outside of your marriage that you know that it's sinful, but the pleasures for now, the pleasures of sin for a season outweigh the blessings of holiness, and the spiritual blessings are going to be yours later on as you keep that family together and you keep those relationships together. But somehow it's just all blurred before you right now because you are controlled by your sexual appetite. Or you may have this insatiable appetite for money and financial security, and it just literally consumes your waking hours. It keeps you awake during your sleeping hours. Your appetite never says enough. Then you are living as a profane person. You've given yourself to your occupation, and all you can see is your profession, your occupation. You're not really thinking about eternity and your spiritual well-being. You are living as Esau, as a profane man. Secondly, a profane person is controlled by his appetite, and he gives away those things of real value, his future inheritance. In this case, in verse 31, is the birthright. Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. He recognized that he had his brother in a jam. The skillful hunter becomes the victim here in this passage. The birthright, which was so important to Jacob, had many advantages. The firstborn son received the status of father. He received a double portion of all the inheritance. So there was prestige, there was power, there was property in this particular connection. It was the passing of the messianic line. It would now go through Jacob rather than through Esau. And he would become the heir to all that God had promised Abraham. Jacob simply wanted what Esau had legitimately coming to him. And Esau's response was somewhat desperate. I'm about to die, so what good is my birthright to me? And as a father, you'd probably look at that and you'd say, you know, if my older son is that dense, that stupid, then he doesn't deserve the birthright. Wouldn't you? If your son did something like this and just gave it away for a little bowl of stew. But before we get too hard on Esau, let's stop and consider what he did. The profane person lives for today. He doesn't worry about what it's going to cost him in terms of his future inheritance because he can see nothing tangible coming from it. Esau could see nothing tangible at this moment, nothing good from his birthright, so he's willing to barter it away, give it away. This person, as we know, lives for this world only. He lives for the now. The things that he sees that are important are the things that he sees as having value. Those things which are important. Houses and businesses and lands and cars and cattle and buildings and gold and silver. He's preoccupied with the temporal. He gives little or no thought to the eternal. That's the essence of the profane or secular person. He throws away the present for the future. Throws away the future rather for the present. Simply lives for today. Like the foolish farmer in Luke chapter 12 that Jesus spoke about, and probably a real farmer in that day who had His lands had brought forth plentifully, and he thought to himself, what do I do with all these goods, all of this grain? What am I going to do? And then he thought within himself, and he said, I know what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns, and I'll build bigger barns, and I'll have bigger and better barns, and I'll put all my goods in those barns, all of my grain in the barns. And then I'll just sit back, and I'll say, take ye, soul, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you're going to die. And that night, God says to him, you fool, this night your soul's going to be required of you. Then whose things are these going to be? And then Luke's comment, Jesus said this. He said, so is he who lays up treasures for himself, but is not rich towards God. And I would ask you this morning, are you rich towards God? Esau was not rich towards God. He represents the man who's living for the moment. Finally, Esau has no regard for the things of lasting spiritual value. Look in verse 34. It says that he gave it away and he even despised it. That may convey a wrong word to us. It literally means he considered it to have no value. In the context of Hebrews chapter 12, it's the antithesis of Hebrews chapter 11, the pilgrims of faith who all died in faith, not having received the promises, but they saw them afar off with their spiritual eyes. Esau, on the other hand, he's willing to just simply give away the future for the present. And the verse indicates that he despised his birthright. To despise it means to hold it in contempt as worthless, something that you can do without. Even though the birthright was God-given, he was willing to give it away. The only importance he attached to it is a bowl of soup. And I would ask you, what is your price? What are you selling out for as a profane person? What is it that's causing you to live as an irreligious person when you're out there in society, outside these walls, during the week? What are you selling out for? I read about some drug dealers recently who sometime back went to the captain of an oil tanker out in L.A., who regularly made trips to South America from Los Angeles. And they offered him $10,000 if he'd bring in a load of cocaine, and he refused at $10,000. A few days later, they came back to him and they offered him $50,000. We'll give you $50,000 cash in hand for one load. And again, he refused to use his oil tanker for that. Finally, they came again. They offered him $150,000. This time he said, I'll take a few days and I'll think about it. And during those few days, he notified the FBI. Now, this literally happened recently. They put together a sting operation and caught the drug runners. And the FBI was able to seize a large shipment of drugs, plus $340,000 in cash of drug money, and a list of all of the buyers in the LA area. It was a major discovery. But it was after the arrest that one of the federal agents began to think, why did this guy wait until they offered him $150,000 to come forward? So they asked him it. See, they said, why did you wait until we offered you $150,000 before you called us? And he replied, they were getting pretty close to my price, and I was scared. Esau had his price, just a bowl of soup, bowl of stew. What's your price? Let's bow together in prayer. You might be here this morning and you've discovered that the things of this world really don't satisfy. There's such an emptiness in your life. But somehow in the study of Jacob and Esau, the Lord has really spoken to you about your own relationship with Him. God seems so far away, so distant. There seems to be a great wall that separates you from Him. And it's because Jesus Christ is the door. And He's the only one who can bring you into God's presence. The only one who can forgive your sin. The only one who can cleanse you and then give you the sure hope of eternal life. A present possession, eternal life. Perhaps in these moments you'd like to just say, Lord Jesus, I acknowledge I am a sinful person. I've been living as Esau. I'm like Esau. I am a material man, or a material woman. And I've been given away the future for the present. I'm involved in a relationship I shouldn't be involved in. I'm consumed by the passion to make money and to be popular. I'm controlled by that. Or you're controlled by something else. What is it? What is it that controls you? You see, that's where God wants to come in and control us. And that keeps us from destroying people around us. You may be a teenager in rebellion this morning. God's really speaking to you. You need to listen to your parents. You need to be moving in spiritual directions rather than physical, material directions. Because you're not, there's all kinds of conflict in your relationships. You need to talk to somebody. You come forward. We've got people here at the end of the service. We'd love to talk to you. Father, thank you for these moments. Thank you for the way you choose to use us. It's all by your grace. Thank you for giving us ears to hear. Help us to apply what we've heard this morning, the principles, to live them through our families, to be able to help others. In Jesus' name, amen.